We're hoping that you can help us reach 500 sustaining members by December 31st by calling 818-985-5735 and pressing option 2. Or you can donate to become a monthly sustainer online at kpfk.org/donate. Happy holidays to everyone, and here's to more power to the people and people-powered radio in 2026.
You're listening to KPFA 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the servants, California and beyond.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, Norman Solomon joins us to discuss how corporate Democrats paved the road to Donald Trump's victories in 2016 and 2024, and how defeating Trump means ousting figures like Chuck Schumer and other unpopular liberal figures from power. Then we'll tackle the problem of plastic use and pollution with Judith Enck, the president and founder of Beyond Plastics, whose new book is The Problem with Plastic: How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. She'll explain if it's possible to have a plastic-free holiday season. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Corporate Democrats pushed progressive alternatives out of the way to promote themselves as alternatives to Trump, and lost in 2016 and 2024. That's the assertion central to a new book by Norman Solomon called The Blue Road to Trump Hell: How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. With 3 long years of Trump's second term stretching before us, Solomon urges a critical analysis of just how destructive figures like Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, and even Barack Obama have been, and why it's essential to defeat them in order to defeat Trumpism. Norman Solomon now joins me. He's National Director of Roots Action and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest books are War Made Invisible and, just published this month, The Blue Road to Trump Hell: How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. Welcome to the program, Norman.
Thank you, Sonali.
So this book is a very detailed and yet extremely straightforward, I have to say, analysis of how it was that Democrats, particularly the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, paved the way for Trump. Now, that's not something we hear very much, if at all, in the mainstream media, that we blame Democrats for the rise of the top Republican, the most dangerous Republican that we've seen in our lifetime, if not ever. So why? Let's talk about, you start the book in the year 2016. And actually, you kind of talk about Obama too in 2009. Where's the good starting point for that analysis that corporate Democrats are to blame for Trump's rise?
Well, I suppose if we go way back, Bill Clinton, who sided with big corporations, who pushed in NAFTA, who did the Telecommunications Reform Act of 1996, which opened the floodgates for monopolization of media, increasingly right-wing. In terms of the book, I do refer to Barack Obama, a hero of many Democratic liberals and so-called moderates, where he came into office. There were millions and millions of people with their mortgages underwater, with toxic mortgages, and he let them sink. And he bailed out Wall Street and the big banks. And so even while Obama sailed into re-election, as Bill Clinton had, he left the party leaders and especially elected Democrats to drown. And so if we trace where we are now, I think we can go back to, in many ways, the 8 years of Obama, both abandoning middle class and low income people at the same time that he let other Democrats sink or swim, often sink, in terms of the rising inequality anger that people justifiably felt. And so what happened during the decade where Obama was in office, basically, 1,000 Democrats lost their seats in state legislatures around the country. So the Republicans came in, ran more and more state governments and the legislatures there, and they were able to reapportion and gerrymander. And we're dealing with that now because the gerrymandering, the rigging of the maps in so many states has allowed the Republicans to dominate the House of Representatives and cast a big shadow over the future. So I'd say basically the corporatization increasingly of the Democratic Party opened the floodgates for the Republicans with their pseudo-populist demagoguery to gain more and more power.
And yet when we saw alternatives in the 2016 election and then the 2020 election, because of course you go through the Biden era as well, we had political pundits blame voters for wanting someone like a Bernie Sanders, who they told us was not viable, quote unquote, although they also thought Trump was not viable, and look how that turned out. And so that blaming of voters and that, I think a lot of liberal, democratic, rank and file people also internalized that analysis. And there was a lot of voter blaming going on. And yet, I want to invite you to again remind us why it's the candidates that were put up by the Democratic Party to blame rather than voters. And even today, we're seeing people blame Trump voters. You know, look at what you brought in. Look at what you ushered in, blaming voters instead of corporate Democrats. So how do you respond to that?
The way to defeat right-wing, xenophobic, racist, populist, pseudo-populist on the right is not with tepid corporatism that basically represents the status quo that those voters are rebelling against. The only way to fight against and defeat these horrible right-wing pseudo-populists now in power under the Trump banner is to pursue the kind of political path that Bernie Sanders has been advocating for decades. And I think back to how in his primary race against Hillary Clinton in 2016, he carried every single county against Hillary Clinton in West Virginia, in this very red state, because he could speak to people's real experiences in terms of an economy that is set up for them to get more and more immiserated while a few more people get rich. And so we have this circumstance where the Democratic Party, from its leadership, has been incapable of countering these claims, these bogus claims from the right wing that people like Trump and his underlings are going to help them in their economic distress. The reason I called the book The Blue Road to Trump Hell is that the hell that we are in, that so many people are suffering from because of the Trump administration, was literally enabled by a Democratic Party that aligned itself with corporate power instead of working people.
Now, the ways in which the 2016 election played out and the 2020 election, and then, of course, the 2024 election played out, these three elections have together resulted in Trump, right? We've had an alternating. We had Obama, we had Trump, we had Biden, we had Trump. And the Biden win was also something that was mostly seemingly a vote against Trump rather than for Biden. And that seems to be the standard approach of corporate Democrats, right? We're not Trump is the gist of what they have to offer. And given Trump's just extremism, perhaps I think one might forgive them for thinking it was enough or not.
One of the themes that we've heard consistently, and you're alluding to, from Democrats is that Trump is so bad he's going to sink himself. That was the basis of the Clinton campaign in 2016. It was the basis of the Biden campaign in 2020, which just barely succeeded. And then, of course, in 2024. And that has proven to not work at all. And a lot of the basis there is the idea that, well, people will see what we see. Well, not necessarily if they're worried at the kitchen table, the proverbial pocketbook issues, and they don't think Democrats are really fighting for them. I think part of the mythology that a lot of conformist Democrats and unfortunately many self-described progressives went in the lead up to the 2024 campaign was this notion that, and this was pushed by the White House, because Biden had defeated Trump once in 2020, he was best positioned to do it again. And that was absolutely bogus. And I should say that my book is mostly written in real time. All the chapters between 2016 and 2024 are written at the time the events occurred. And I emphasize that because this is not about hindsight. Sonali, on your program for many years, you have been talking about and having guests illuminating how these corporate Democrats cannot defeat the right wing. No, it's not just something that nobody knew at the time. Many progressives were saying this at the time. And one of the key points that I make in the book is that in 2020, Trump was defending an unpopular status quo. In 2024, Biden and then Harris were defending an even more unpopular status quo. And it's the insulation of Democratic Party elites and their pals on Wall Street and the tech sector, the gazillionaires that they hobnob with. And by the way, Hakeem Jeffries just this year has been going out to Silicon Valley and telling these high donors that he's going to move the party farther away from the left. So this is the attitude that then alienates the base of the party from turning out and voting. And one of the recurring patterns that I write about in the book is something that was notoriously stated flat out by New York Senator Chuck Schumer back in 2016. He said explicitly, publicly, that for every vote we lose from people who live in the city, who are more low income, implicitly people of color, we'll pick up two white suburban voters. That didn't work in 2016. It didn't work in 2024. But Kamala Harris had the same attitude, and she campaigned with Liz Cheney. And I have a piece way back before the 2024 campaign got rolling when Harris did do this duo campaigning with Liz Cheney. I wrote that Democrats should stay away from Liz Cheney and these Republicans because there are very few Republican votes to have. And I think underneath all that is that when the Democratic Party leadership is afraid of its base, afraid of lower income people, afraid of people of color and progressives, then where do they turn? They turn to the almost mythical Republican voters who they think they can peel away from Trump. And this is not only about the past. As I say in the book, this is not only about understanding the history of how we got here. It's also to grasp and put into effect the lessons that we've got to learn so that we don't have a President Vance.
I definitely want to talk about the way forward, but just staying on this for a little bit about where the Democratic Party went wrong and continues to go wrong. You point out in your book that, you know, the campaigns are centered on we're not Trump, but then as soon as Trump is in power, the normalization of Trump is something that Democrats are also guilty of. And this is something that, of course, frustrates their own base. And a lot of Democrats have simply left the party, right?
Yeah. I have a closing chapter called 2025 and Beyond. And I really chronicle how so many Democrats have, as you say, tacitly normalized what Trump is about, and the goalposts keep moving rightward. The Overton window keeps being shut down by the tacit acceptance of so many of the premises of what Donald Trump is imposing, which is a fascistic politics. And when, as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that Hakeem Jeffries went to Silicon Valley and said, look, we're going to move the party more to, quote, the center. There's nothing moderate about a status quo with so much poverty, vast income inequality, massive militarism, what Martin Luther King called the madness of militarism. Nothing moderate about that at all. But here you have the top Democrat in the House saying to these really rich donors, don't worry, we're going to tail the Republicans. We're in the farther right that the Trump people go, these neo-fascists, these fascists, who are leading the MAGA movement and are in the White House, the more they move right, we don't want to have too much distance, so we'll move towards the center. Well, that's bass-ackwards. It's the way to move fascism forward. And the great analyst of fascism, Jason Stanley, has pointed out that it's often considered to be not real when fascism becomes more real because the goalposts keep moving. And we've experienced that for many years now. What seems outrageous in the public media, in mass media, that Trump does one month, the next month is ho-hum. That's the way things are.
Right. And, you know, and perhaps one of the reasons Hakeem Jeffries is going to Silicon Valley is because the Democrats have also not just tried to peel off those mythical centrist Republican voters, but turned, of course, to corporations, hence the term corporate Democrats, for backing, because they have decided that the only way to win elections is through money. So fundraising becomes a strategy. And therefore, in order to win, and then they promise us in order to deliver their supposedly progressive agenda, they have to get the donations from corporate America. But we have someone like Zoran Mamdani showing that actually you need voters, young voters, voters who've peeled away from both parties, young voters and people who have diverse communities that have sat out the process, who've become apathetic. You have voters. You can win them over and do so by issuing corporate money altogether. Is that, let's talk about the way forward then. Is that one of the paths out of Trump hell?
That's one of the electoral paths forward that so frightens the corporate Democrats and the right wing. Zoran Mamdani, Bernie Sanders have shown that you don't have to finance an election campaign by going to the big money, the people with the big, deep pockets. And that's frightening to the power structure. You know, we were talking about when Trump came in, the accommodation to Trump was, and I say this in the book, it was a shock to the system when Trump became president in 2017, but the system soon more and more accommodated, and it was no longer such a shock. The path forward electorally certainly involves doing what Bernie Sanders has done twice in presidential campaigns. A lot of small recurring donations can easily match the Michael Bloombergs and these other gazillionaires who really do not respect democracy. They want to buy elections, and usually they get away with it. So I think that is really the future, and it explains why, and I outline this in the book extensively, both of the presidential campaigns of Bernie Sanders withstood enormous vilification, smears, 16 articles against Bernie Sanders in 16 hours in the Washington Post, owned by one of the richest people in the world, Jeff Bezos. This is the kind of media terrain we're dealing with, and it's why not only the media and the corporate political establishment are trying to stop progressive candidates from winning, but it's also why progressive media outlets are so important, including this program, that when we have millions of people who are reached every day with progressive news and information and analysis, which is increasingly the case, it's a way to push back against corporate media propaganda.
So going forward in 2028, well, we've got the midterm elections coming up next year, which will be an interesting test of where the nation is. But then in 2028, the corporate Democrats are going to have their candidates. They're going to put them forward. However, there seems to be a reconfiguring in the party at the moment with Nancy Pelosi stepping down, you know, Chuck Schumer's future looking not very bright. And there definitely seems to be more appetite among young folks doing primary challenges to Democrats, even in safe blue, especially in safe blue districts. So there's going to be this battle playing out over the 2025 nominee, and the seeds of it seem to be getting sowed right now. Do you feel that the next 4 years are going to be crucial? And I ask this question not because you and I care about the future of the Democratic Party, far from it, but of course we care about the future of the country not being under fascist dictatorial Republican leadership enabled by corporate Democrats. So what is this fight, you think, going to look like, and what should progressives be readying for? Because unfortunately, we tend to fight a lot amongst ourselves.
Well, progressive challenges to incumbent Democrats will be absolutely crucial in the primaries coming up in 2026. And if this hadn't happened, we wouldn't have Ayanna Pressley, we wouldn't have Ilhan Omar, we wouldn't have Ro Khanna. These people and more were willing and able to challenge incumbent Democrats in primaries. And, you know, Zoran Mandani, he was and is a Democrat. The new mayor of Seattle coming in is a also self-described Democratic socialist. We wouldn't have Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar in Congress right now if they hadn't run as, quote, a Democrat. And as you say, it's not a matter of loyalty to the Democratic Party. It's a matter of realism about how do you stop these fascistic so-called leaders of the Republican Party, and also how do you advance in governance a progressive agenda? So I think on all counts, social movements are what it's all about. Electoral campaigns should be subsets of social movements, not the other way around. But without gaining electoral power and getting our people into government, we will be only protesting and we won't be winning changes in policy. And I do, as we wrap up, I want to mention that the past is crucial, and it also teaches us, or we will be scammed again and again. And it's one reason why this book from the outset is free to people. This is extremely unusual. I'm really happy to say that after more than a dozen books that I've written, this one from the very beginning is free. And anybody can go online to blueroad.info, download it as an ebook, as a PDF, and read it online. So people are invited, blueroad.info.
And I should also mention that the book is illustrated beautifully by cartoonist Matt Worker, if you want to mention a little bit about that.
Well, Matt Worker has been a progressive, wonderfully creative cartoonist. I say that the great cartoonist of the 19th century, Thomas Nast, the great cartoonist of the 20th century, Herb Bloch, have been succeeded by Matt Worker, who is an anomaly. He's at Politico magazine. He has done a lot of cartooning for decades for progressive outlets, and there's nobody better. And in 11 full-color cartoons, he captures the gist of what's wrong with corporate Democrats and what's possible for a creative future.
Norman, I want to end with one last question to you, which is, what advice do you have for progressives who tend to fight amongst ourselves? One of the things that I see tripping people up over and over again is sort of purity tests. For example, you've mentioned some folks like Zoran Mamdani, like the new mayor of Seattle, Katie Wilson, like Ro Khanna, even Bernie Sanders, who don't always do what we all agree with all the time, right? Many folks were frustrated that Bernie Sanders didn't call what was happening in Gaza a genocide sooner. Ro Khanna has also capitulated on the issue of Israel. We didn't even talk about Israel, but you know, there's plenty to discuss there. But I'm wondering if you have any advice for progressives who feel so tied and so passionate to wanting to salvage their nation that we might dismiss candidates if they fail certain purity tests, because I think we have a propensity to want to make it about individuals, to fall in love with individuals and then discard them when they inevitably disappoint us, like any individual would.
I think it was Eugene Debs who said, if I could lead people to socialism, I wouldn't do it, because if I could lead them to socialism, I could lead them away from it. And it's about grassroots organizing and understanding and having a sense of social movements that, as you allude to, should never depend on any one individual or set of individuals. And so while we should stay, as the saying goes, true to our North Star, to our values, our beliefs, our progressive vision of the future, also to recognize that people change over time and that they will be susceptible to pressure. And the two examples you gave are great, because Bernie Sanders was very slow to full-throated oppose the genocide that Israel has been committing in Gaza. People did sit-ins in his office. He probably didn't like that. But so to speak, he came around, and he's been a great voice against Israel in the Senate and in the country. Ro Khanna as well is now, just in the last few weeks, having an escalating fight with AIPAC. AIPAC is denouncing him. They're spending money against him in the district because he has signed on to a bill that declares that Israel is committing genocide. Those are just a couple of examples of when people organize, the changes can come. When the people lead, the leaders will follow. Not always, but the more that we lead from the grassroots, the more positivity for social change is possible.
Thank you so much for joining us, Norman.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sonali.
My guest has been Norman Solomon, National Director of Roots Action and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. We've been talking about his latest book just out this month called The Blue Road to Trump Hell: How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. It's available for a free download at blueroad.info. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. We are awash in plastics, from the polyester clothing on our backs to the glasses on our faces, the polish on our nails, the packaging of our food, and even the microplastics flowing through our blood. In less than a century, plastic has revolutionized our lives and leaves a legacy that is slowly poisoning us. Now, as we enter the thick of holiday season, the plastic consumption is ramping up. From plastic toys and gifts and gift wrap to plastic packaged foods and dinnerware and more. Can we free ourselves of plastic? That's a question that my guest Judith Enck attempts to answer. She's founder and president of Beyond Plastics, an organization whose goal is eliminating plastic pollution everywhere. She was appointed by President Obama to serve as regional administrator at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2009 and served as deputy secretary for the environment in the New York governor's office. She's currently a professor at Bennington College and has a new book out called The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. Welcome to the program, Judith.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
I think a lot of people understand now that plastic is a problem, but maybe they're not as aware just how deeply embedded it is in our lives and actually in our bodies itself. I remember the first time I read about microplastics polluting the ocean, you know, from those little tiny beads that some manufacturers decided it would be good to put in things like lotion and soap, to finding out that plastic filaments are in our bloodstream, and it was quite shocking. So how do you explain how that even happens? How does plastic get into our bodies? We just surround ourselves with so much plastic, it's just everywhere now?
Well, none of us voted for more plastic. The reason we have so much plastic is because there is a glut of fracked gas on the market. Historically, plastics were made from oil and chemicals. Today, it's made from 16,000 different chemicals and ethane, which is a byproduct of fracking. Because there's a glut of fracked gas, fossil fuel companies are using that waste product to produce new plastic products. The way plastics get into our bodies is we're either breathing it in or we're swallowing, particularly from food and beverage packaging. And the health consequences are quite significant. So scientific researchers have found the presence of microplastics in our blood, our lungs, our kidney, our heart arteries, where they've seen microplastics attached to plaque. If you've got microplastics on plaque, you have a much greater risk of developing heart disease, stroke, premature death. Unfortunately, there was a recent study that found microplastics crossing the blood-brain barrier. And when that happens, you have an increased risk of neurological disease, including Alzheimer's. And then perhaps most concerning is microplastics have been found in testicles, in breast milk, and in the human placenta, both the fetal side and the maternal side. And that concerns me because the baby is only hanging out for 7, 8, 9 months and is already being exposed to microplastics. Our babies are being born pre-polluted.
You point out in your book, The Problem with Plastic, that the 2023 train derailment carrying polyvinyl plastics in East Palestine, Ohio, is really symbolic of so much that is wrong with our plastic polluted planet. Tell us about that particular accident and what was done after that accident that worsened a problem that was already quite serious. I can't quite wrap my head around the fact that authorities thought that it would be a good idea to burn a bunch of plastic in a community as a way to get rid of it.
Yeah, this is a terrible story. So this is a story about a highly toxic chemical, vinyl chloride, that is every day put on trains that go by on rickety train tracks around the country. 99% of the carcinogenic carcinogenic chemical vinyl chloride is used to make polyvinyl chloride or PVC plastic. So there was a train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, which is very close to the Ohio-Pennsylvania border. Sadly, there are train derailments in this country very frequently. What was different here is the authorities and first responders got the fire out within 24 hours, thank goodness, with no loss of life. And then they had to decide, what do you do with all of this chemical that is either still in the train cars or spilled in ditches and in the soil near the train tracks? Now, interestingly, I dealt with a somewhat similar situation of a train derailment of this very same chemical in New Jersey when I served at the EPA during the Obama administration. And standard protocol is you would bring vacuum trucks to the site, suck out the chemical, and then bring it to a commercial hazardous waste disposal facility. That did not happen in East Palestine, Ohio. Very unwisely, the decision was made to drain the chemicals into ditches and then set it on fire and have an open burn of vinyl chloride. And some of your listeners might recall this iconic big black mushroom cloud that went over the whole region. And unfortunately, that has affected people's health. It certainly affected their lives. And I believe that that decision was made because Norfolk Southern, the rail company, and the governor of Ohio wanted to get that busy rail corridor opened up as quickly as possible and didn't follow more conservative and careful techniques on how to deal with this problem. So people may not think of that train derailment as related to plastic, but it is, because, again, the chemical vinyl chloride is mostly used to make polyvinyl chloride or PVC plastic. This is the same plastic that is in children's toys, the classic yellow rubber ducky that children play with in the bathtub. That's made from PVC plastic. Shower curtains are made from PVC plastic. And drinking water pipes are made from PVC plastic. So Beyond Plastics recommends that when communities are replacing drinking water pipes, that they not use PVC plastic as a substitute for lead pipes.
So we have a very, very dire situation where there's just so much momentum to keep creating plastic products from all of this available byproduct of fracking that you were saying that we have. It's cheap, it's available. We just finished Black Friday, the shopping season is ramping up. And almost everything we buy, if it's not itself plastic, is often packaged and wrapped in plastic. Is it even possible to, you know, remove plastic from our lives? Let's talk about the solutions to this problem. You write about many of them, from things like refill stores to repair cafes. Let's talk about the general solutions first before we get to how we can even make our holiday season mostly, at least, plastic free. What tell me about the refill stores that exist that allow people to remove plastic from their lives.
Yeah, there are definitely viable alternatives to plastic. The best thing is waste reduction, which also includes refill and reuse. So we're seeing literally hundreds of small businesses pop up around the country where people can get their products in refillable containers, typically glass. We want to see that become more mainstream. For instance, there are parts of the world where soda is sold in refillable glass bottles. You bring it back after you pay your deposit. And
that
was
the case, Judith, just to interrupt you. When I was growing up and I would visit India with my family, we got sodas in glass bottles that we had to either consume on the spot to return the bottles or bring them back if we were consuming them at home, and you would get your deposit back too. And it was just normal. And then, of course, India caught up, quote unquote, with the West And now we have these disposable plastic bottles, etc., as well, which is just so sad. So we already had an era where such things were part of our lives.
You're absolutely right. That is a common story for all over the world. Also in India, you probably know, a lot of people take their lunch in stainless steel tiffins rather Yep. than single-use disposable plastics. I grew up drinking milk out of refillable glass bottles. So, you know, we're not talking about rocket science. And if you cannot have refillable, reusable, then at least shift to material like paper, cardboard, metal, and glass. All of that can be made of recycled material and actually does get recycled when you put it in your recycling bin. But for reuse and refill to work, we've got to build a refill reuse infrastructure. What I mean by that is children, for instance, go to school, they're served breakfast and or lunch, often on single-use disposable plastic plates and cups and utensils. How about installing dishwashing equipment and serving our children meals on reusable dishes? When you go to the airport, you see a water refill station. You can bring your own refillable water bottle and not have to pay $2 for plastic water bottles. Why don't we have those water refill stations and water fountains in train stations and bus stations and public parks?
It took work and activism and lobbying to get those refill stations in mm-hmm. airports by activists. So, you know, those didn't just magically appear because airports and the corporate sponsors at airports decided that it would be a great thing to do. People pushed for it to happen, right?
Exactly. And that's the whole point of the book, The Problem with Plastic, is we present the many problems with plastic, whether it's climate change, health, how we're turning our ocean into a landfill. But we also provide practical solutions and political strategies. How do you contact your local airport and say, I want more refill stations? How do you get your school to invest in reusable dishes? You're absolutely right. Rarely does it happen on its own. I'm a big believer in the phrase, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. And, you know, this is a book for people who want to change the world, who want to engage with government, with businesses, with their communities to get us off of the plastic treadmill. This is very much linked to how we've become a disposable society. And the reason why I founded my organization, Beyond Plastics, and the reason why we wrote this book is because it's really fundamentally about needing our business practices and our culture to be more sustainable. What I mean by that is the United States has 4% of the world's population, and yet we use 16% of the world's energy. We create about 12% of the world's solid waste, and we create about 17% of the world's plastic waste. We're 4% of the world's population.
A lot of folks want to find alternatives to plastic. And I want to ask you about that, because you said reducing our use, reducing our reliance on plastic is really, really important. But people are pivoting to compostable bioplastics. You know, my own family, we've been using these trash bags, the little thin, green, flimsy plastic bags. And then I read your book and I thought, oh, crap. That's not a good alternative. Let's talk about that, because we're also, you know, seeing these corn-based styrofoam alternatives. Mm-hmm. There are so-called bioplastics and greener plastics everywhere. And it's, you know, it's reminding me of the debate around coal when the pro-coal people invented this bizarre thing called clean coal.
Right.
Is there such a thing as compostable plastic or bioplastic?
Well, not really. I mean, we're not closing the door entirely. There are some breakthroughs with mycelium, which is a type of mushroom, and also seaweed. But most of the products that are on the market today that are presented as compostable plastics have two or three major problems. One is many of them still contain PFAS chemicals and other chemicals. Second, they don't actually biodegrade unless you send them to a high temperature commercial composting facility, which most communities do not have. And third, it interferes with a really important composting strategy. So if you want composting to succeed, and we all do because it's about 40% of the waste stream and a major source of methane gas emissions, but if you want composting to work, you have to carefully control the inputs of what you're trying to compost. And it really should just be yard waste and food waste. If those are your clean inputs, in the end, you're going to get this rich soil amendment that improves soil health and also serves as a carbon sink. When you start adding things like so-called compostable plastic straws and plates and bags, a lot of that does not degrade, and you're transforming composting from a soil health strategy into a waste disposal strategy. And you're also expecting people to spend more money for these compostable plastics. So we are not fans of compostable plastics, although we do not completely shut the door to them in case there's innovation. It's innovation we've been waiting for about 30 years. So again, the focus really needs to be on using less plastic, whether it's traditional plastic or so-called compostable plastic.
And also, there's so much, even things that are not single-use plastic, even say multi-use plastic, there's so much waste from products, from appliances that break down because they're cheaply made. And then, we tend to think, oh, this would cost me $50 to repair and $40 to just buy a brand new version of the same thing. That also adds to landfills and plastic pollution. But there are alternatives, such as repair cafes, if you can't afford to pay somebody to repair your item, or it's, just not a thing that there's an industry built around. Tell me about repair cafes.
Oh, I love repair cafes, and they are popping up all over the country. People can just Google repair cafes, other strategies like FreeCycle and donating old furniture. We recently had
The
to
Buy Nothing
get,
groups are also very
buy
popular.
nothing. Absolutely. But repair cafes are what it sounds like. Volunteers get together, usually on a Saturday morning. And you can show up with, your toaster or your blender or your radio that needs repair. What you cannot show up with is your iPhone, typically, or your computer. And it sure seems like we've got companies pushing planned obsolescence. Good luck getting your iPhone repaired. Very hard to do. And the companies want you to spend massive amounts of money replacing your iPhone every few years, your computer every few years, your iPad every few years. And that creates not just a lot of plastic waste, but also electronic waste. So toxic chemicals in the batteries. And a lot of the old iPhones and computers and cell phones are actually shipped to other countries in what we call the plastic waste trade, where parts of these products are burned off and then they try to retrieve some material that actually could be recycled at great health risk to the people who are doing this.
All right, so let's talk about how we can apply some of what we've been discussing and some of what you write about in your book, The Problem with Plastic, to our holiday season. As I said, people are shopping. They're, you know, fulfilling their gift lists. They're hosting dinners. There's so much plastic everywhere. Is it possible to have a plastic-free or mostly plastic-free holiday season? And if so, any tips that you can share?
Yes, it's entirely possible. And on our website, beyondplastics.org, we often will post in advance of holidays. We just did how to have a plastic-free Thanksgiving get-together. So for Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, there are many, many options. If you're hosting people in your home, serve them on reusable dishes and reusable glassware. If you don't have enough because you've got a big crowd of unruly relatives coming, you can rent glassware and plates and beautiful reusable tablecloths and napkins from local vendors. I had a zero waste party a couple years ago, and I was able to get all of that rented. It's a little bit more expensive than single-use disposables, but, you know, your family is worth it, and it looks nicer.
When it comes to a talking point around the dinner table.
Absolutely. Much better
maybe,
to talk
maybe get
about
people
that.
Maybe get people to come and help you wash all the dishes, you know,
when you're renting the plates, you just return it dirty. But if you're using your own plates at home, which I often do, yes, you definitely want to have fun conversations while you're loading the dishwasher or washing the dishes. When it comes to toys, try to avoid plastic toys, especially for the little ones, because they're often putting it in their mouth. For older people, consider giving experiences rather than material products. So, you know, taking little kids to a matinee movie or giving your aunts and uncles, you know, tickets to a concert or a play, giving busy parents a couple coupons that you'll go and babysit their kids on a Saturday night. I think gifts like that are so much more meaningful and do not involve massive amounts of plastic. So there definitely is a way, but to have plastic-free holidays or plastic-reduced holidays, but it requires a little bit of thought in advance. And we probably still have last year's December holiday gifts up on our website. So, you know, some of the stuff is really obvious. Some of the stuff, you read it and it's like, that's a good idea. Like, for instance, make sure you compost your food waste. How do you compost? We've got information like that.
And also there are options to gift things that are gently used. I mean, I know that sometimes people think it's icky to give like secondhand items, but shopping at thrift stores, you can find beautiful vintage treasures that, you know, just can be wrapped in reusable paper and gifted.
Absolutely. And I've had wrapping paper, you know, for the last 20 years. I don't remember the last time I actually bought wrapping paper. You just have to carefully open your gifts and then save the wrapping paper. But again, it's all about sustainability. And it's not only good for the planet, it's also good for your own health. You know, making sure little kids are not drinking from plastic sippy cups and making sure that clothing and household items not made from polyester, as you mentioned in the opening. You know, one little suggestion I have is you spend a lot of time sleeping, so make sure your sheets and your blankets are cotton and not polyester, because you will avoid some exposure that way.
And also, finally, it's one thing to create change in one's own lives. It's another thing to change policy, as we were mentioning with, you know, getting water refill stations in airports. It is activism that gets the goods on the mass scale. And that's something you're also familiar with and you write about in your book. Once we're past holiday season, it's time for New Year's resolutions. And for those people who want to make a resolution about doing something around plastic pollution in their local communities, what advice can you give?
Well, it's a great New Year's resolution. And in fact, our publisher, our friends at the New Press, moved the publication date of the book from January to December, thinking people will be making some New Year's resolutions. So, you know, my first suggestion is read the book. It has a lot of good substantive information in it. And then jump into the political arena. Show up at a city council meeting. Talk to your neighbors.
And you mentioned that a lot of the leaders in this movement against plastic pollution, they're largely women, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, there is a huge gender gap. It's mostly women that are actively working on this issue. And we profile 10 of them in the book, women who live in Louisiana and Texas who are standing up to big plastic companies, Sharon Levine with Rise St. James, Louisiana, Diane Wilson with San Antonio Bay Waterkeeper. We also profile my friend Debbie Lee Cohen, who had children in the New York City public school system, and she was concerned that the children were being served food directly on polystyrene trays. The trade name is Styrofoam. She thought that was not a good idea, because styrene, a known carcinogen, is in polystyrene. So she took it upon herself to work with some other parents to get the New York City school system, the largest public school system in the country, to stop using polystyrene trays. And she succeeded. And sadly, so after she did that, she founded an organization that I highly recommend called Cafeteria Culture. They have a curriculum for teachers on plastics. And then sadly, this past summer, Debbie Lee Cohen succumbed to cancer. And it's just, you know, really hard to think about how she spent so much of her life trying to protect people from the health risks of plastics. And we know that of the 16,000 chemicals used to make plastics, many are carcinogenic. And then she herself succumbed to cancer. So I'm glad we could talk about her work in the book. And we dedicate the book to people living near plastic production facilities.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Judith, for joining us today. So much more we could discuss in your book, but certainly folks can pick up a copy, gift it for the holidays.
It's a great gift, and get one for your library. And I want to point out that the cover is plastic free. So kudos to our publisher for getting us a plastic free cover.
I mean, I honestly wouldn't have even expected there to be plastic. So book covers have plastic too?
Virtually every book cover has a plastic lining on it. Yes. But not the problem with plastic.
There we go. And maybe that can be the first of many books that do that. Judith, I want to thank you again so much for joining us. Also, there's a website for the organization you run, Beyond Plastics. Give that out.
Sure. Beyondplastics.org. So plural, beyondplastics.org.
And we'll link to that from our website. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Judith Enck, founder and president of Beyond Plastics. And she was appointed by President Obama to serve as regional administrator at the U.S. EPA in 2009. And she's currently a professor at Bennington College. And we've been talking about her new book, The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally dedicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated